Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Millions of Americans right now are in the air or on the road. And I pray the Lord gets you safely where you are headed. And hopefully you are headed towards family and a festival feast of Thanksgiving. And I pray that's everything that you will hope and prepare it to be. And all across America right now, there are kitchens that are alive with activity. And there are some that are just now warming up for a big day of cooking tomorrow. And the Wall Street Journal raises a very interesting issue concerning that in a news story that was published last week entitled A Mailable Feast. That's right, mailable, as in the postal service. There are an awful lot of Americans who have decided that the Thanksgiving meal is just too much trouble to prepare, and so they are buying it, lock, stock, and barrel, so to speak. They're having it delivered to their homes. Let me just quote from the Wall Street Journal story. It says this: Thanksgiving dinner has a new mail order twist. More retailers are offering all-in-one, fully prepared feasts shipped in on dry ice or ice packs that require little more than reheating. The author of the story goes on and says, look, we're living in a microwave instant society, and there are an awful lot of people who just don't know how to cook anymore. Now, I'm going to launch out into a little bit of controversy here, and I tell you, as you're headed towards Thanksgiving, I'm going to give a tribute to those who are cooking and who are demonstrating their love through preparing this kind of feast. By the way, let me just tell you that it doesn't come inexpensively to have a mail order Thanksgiving. The Wall Street Journal quotes prices from Felser Brothers, the Honey Baked Ham Company, Gourmet Station, Harry and David, and Stockyards. And these are pretty expensive. Six to eight, the dinner from Felser Brothers, $122.95. If you want to add crispy asparagus, that's $34.95. You just start looking at the prices here. They're pretty high, but the convenience level is also high. You just pop it in the microwave, warm it up, put it on the table, and there you go. But all across America right now, there are especially wives and mothers, grandmothers, and extended family in the kitchen. And I know some of you are already saying, well, that's sexist. Well, it's also the truth, folks. The vast majority of homes, we're all thankful that it's not husband and dad who are cooking. Let me just say, as one husband and dad, my family is very, very thankful that my wife is doing the cooking and not me. But there's something that is missing in a lot of homes. And I just want to encourage folks to recover this. Recover the real ministry of the kitchen and recover what it means to cook a meal from scratch and recover what it means to make the kitchen that lively place of activity, not only where food is heated, but where food is cooked. And I have to tell you, you know, I look across this society, I see an awful lot of young women who don't even know how to cook because they haven't been taught to cook. They didn't have to learn. You know, that used to be something that was rather essential in terms of learning, and now it's not so much so. And I just want to give a tribute to all those moms and wives and women and grandmothers and others who are out there cooking and, you know, bring some young ones in there, too, and teach them how to do it as well. And, yes, I know that's a sexist statement. And yes, I want to say your sons should know how to feed themselves from time to time as well. But I just have to tell you that you do not want to live in a society where the husbands and the fathers do most of the cooking. We would be thinner and we would be less happy. No doubt about it. Folks, there is so much going on in the world even now. I'm going to be talking about one book that is now out in the bookstores that ought to have our attention. But I have to tell you that even as things get stranger and stranger over here in Great Britain, it can be even more unusual. I've been talking to you from time to time about the United Kingdom Advertising Standards Authority's copy advice team. And this just shows you how political correctness can be taken to lengths that are almost unbelievable. In May of this year, the manufacturers of Lambrini, which is defined as a pear-flavored, semi-sparkling party drink, something tells me that's what Rush Limbaugh calls an adult beverage. It's probably an alcoholic beverage. It was seeking to advertise, and this official UK advertising standards authorities copy advice team came back and wrote them, suggesting that that they had to use ugly men in the advertisement rather than attractive men, because using attractive men would lead people to believe that by drinking this beverage they would be made thin and athletic and handsome. Now, I know that advertising can be subtle and powerful and effective, but are we really supposed to believe that out there somewhere, there is somebody who looks nothing like the guy in this advertisement who says, you know, if I just drink a Lambrini, that's what I'm going to look like. I don't think so. Now, they were also upset about some other things because there was what's known as a paddling pool in the advertisement. They said this, and this is, I'm quoting from the letter sent by this governmental authority to this company. It said, I should point out that the pool should not be too deep, as this may be seen as encouraging unsafe behavior. In its current form, the pool does look quite deep, and therefore it should probably be a little shallower in the final. Okay. I don't have a clue what to do with this, except I want to tell you that this same kind of logic is crossing the pond. You know, the same kind of logic of political correctness can be found in the United States as well. We do not yet have anything like this governmental advertising standards authority, and we should be thankful for that, because what they're concerned about is not what I'd be concerned about in advertising. I'm concerned about the kind of pornography I see in advertising. I'm concerned for the kind of crass commercialism I see in advertising. I'm concerned for the immodesty. I'm concerned for the presentation of a false lifestyle. But, you know, this is the opposite, really, in terms of this political correctness. And, you know, it is a reminder. That's why I wanted to talk about it today. It is a reminder to us of the power of advertising. And even though I don't think there's anybody out there that's going to look at this and say, hey, if I drink this or if I buy that or if I wear that, I'm going to look like this guy. And I'll get the girls like he does, and I'll have all the female attention, and I'll be powerful and rich and persuasive and all the rest. Advertising does work in very subtle ways on all of us. I was talking to someone the other day who was talking about his own teenage daughter, and he said, you know, when I talk to my daughter about what she likes, I'm not even sure where it comes from. But we were talking, and he said, you know, I'm increasingly convinced that it does come from some of the subtle signals sent out there in the culture. And I think we all actually know that. And so with the Christmas commercial season just about to come, I think one of the things we need to do with our children on this day, when many of us are headed for Thanksgiving, and you know the paper is going to be open and all those advertisements are going to fall out of the paper tomorrow morning, and people start looking at them and oohing and aahing at all these products and all these advertisements, it's a warning to us all that we need to help to teach our children that that they need to learn how not to be seduced by this kind of advertising. Folks, there are all kinds of things out there of which we ought to be aware, but there's a book out in the bookstore, and I wrote about this some time ago because I wanted people to know about it, and an issue brought to mind this book again, and so I have republished this article at albertmuller.com. It's entitled The Teen Code, A Wake-Up Call for Parents. It's a book by a 17-year-old boy by the name of Rhett Godfrey, and he writes to parents about how they should talk to their teenagers and how they should approach their teenagers about sensitive issues, including alcohol and tobacco and sex. And he basically says, American parents, you need to understand that we're going to smoke and we're going to drink and we're going to have sex, and you just have to deal with it. And he makes the most amazing statements in this book. Now, what surprises me is not that there's a 17-year-old boy who would write this kind of book. Frankly, they would have the audacity to write this kind of book and would have the opening in the publishing industry to get it published and all the rest, although I believe his mother is an agent, and that may have something to do with it. What surprises me is that that his mother also writes in the book, and she basically agrees with him. She basically validates the very points he's trying to make. And many of the illustrations he uses in his book are of teenagers who basically tell their parents, look, here's the moral code I'm going to live by, deal with it, and the parents do. For instance, you have one mom who discovers some very questionable material in her daughter's room. And I say very questionable. I'm not even going to go into the specifics on the air. And she is castigated for violating her daughter's privacy. You know what? I don't think my parents thought I had any such right to privacy when I was a teenager living in the house. I just can't imagine it. I didn't show up with an attorney and say, here's my right to privacy. You know, here's the approach. If she's living in your house, it's your room. You know, it's not her room. And, you know, the idea that our teenagers have a right to privacy, which would cover their ability to have contraband substances and all the rest, that just blows my mind. I just can't believe there are parents out there who would agree with this. And yet there are in this book. Such suggestions made by parents as, look, you know, you want your kids to have safe sex, so why don't you put a cookie jar there on the bar in the kitchen and fill it up with condoms. That way, if your teenager needs one, he or she can just take one, and it'll save the embarrassment of you having to talk about it. Save you the embarrassment of having to talk about it. You know, what kind of world is this? Well, it's the world in which we live. It's the world increasingly being shaped by popular culture, by the media, by Hollywood. It's now being shaped by those who are writing and publishing books like The Teen Code, which you can find at your local bookseller. And all this is a reminder to us that that parents are here for a purpose. God gave children parents in order that we can make parent not just a noun, but a verb. God's given us a job to do, and that job is to teach our children, to discipline our children, to protect our children, to teach our children not to put a cookie jar full of condoms on the jar on the bar in the kitchen, not to facilitate, not to consider they have a zone of privacy in which they can simply do what they want to do. But rather, they are our children. They are our stewardship. We will give an answer to God for how we raise them, how we protect them. And yes, sometimes, for how we invade their privacy. Be bold. Invade. Protect. They're your kids. Folks, when you're headed to be with your family, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. We're going to be back for a fascinating discussion. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. You call with your question. The phone number, 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. You get to set the agenda. We'll talk about what you want to talk about on the day before Thanksgiving. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. As you are traveling, many of you, of course, from your home to be with family, or family is on the way to you, and whatever your situation, glad you're joining us today. Watch out for the turkeys. The Wall Street Journal has a cover story, front page story today, warning that there are wild turkeys that are now attacking humans in suburbia. Now, if this was in the National Enquirer, I wouldn't give it much attention, but on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, this commands and demands some time. According to this, as Americans prepare to eat some 46 million domestic turkeys slaughtered for Thanksgiving, their wild cousins are fighting back. The explosion of the wild turkey population to nearly 7 million from just 30,000 in the 1930s has put a growing number of humans in the face of angry gobblers. Patricia Huckery, a Massachusetts Wildlife Department district manager just west of Boston, says she has gotten 25 calls this year for advice on coping with aggressive turkeys. You know, folks, life is complicated enough without having to wonder and worry about aggressive turkeys. But listen, today you get ready to be aggressive with your turkey tomorrow. And we'll worry about the wild turkeys later on. Let's go to your calls. From South Carolina, we have Stacy calling on XM Satellite Radio. Stacy, your turn.
Yeah, the question I had was the Ninth Circuit Court, their recent ruling on the sexual survey.
Yes,
you know,
sir.
Judge Reinhold left it open. You know, any content taught in the public schools wasn't, you know, concern of the parents. Now, wouldn't that open that up to Christian teaching? I mean, just like Joseph, you know, Joseph told his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." I mean, couldn't we take advantage of this and use it to our...
Well, I'll try to figure out with you how we could do that, Stacy. The decision was limited to sex education there in the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Stephen Reinhart, and you had him just nailed there, he said the parents have no right to put any limitations about what their children will be taught in terms of sex education in the public schools. I'm not able to see how we can turn that to our advantage. He basically said that the public schools never have to answer to parents. And the very last paragraph of that decision, he said that the public schools are not accountable to parents for what they will teach about any subject in any form or any manner they may choose. However, they are accountable, Judge Reinhart made very clear, to the courts. And that's the whole point, isn't it, Stacy? I mean, that's the most frustrating thing about this. This decision basically said that parents have to just back off. Once, as a matter of fact, he used threshold language. He said, once you bring your children to the threshold of the public school door, you surrender your control over what they're taught the moment they cross that threshold. And so he basically told parents to back off, and yet the courts aren't going to back off. The courts are going to continue to push the secularization of the public schools. You seeing something I'm missing, Stacy? I'm glad to hear from you.
Well, everybody keeps saying, you know, any content. So that's not limiting it to sex education then. I mean, even though the case was pertaining to the sex survey, he ended it with any content being taught in public school.
Yeah, but he said the public schools get to decide that. And yet they're still, I guarantee you, with Stephen Reinhart and with the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, he would still hold them accountable to what they would characterize as the separation of church and state. And by the way, he's ruled that way in other decisions. And that's one of the infuriating things about this particular case before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Stephen Reinhart has been one pushing the envelope on the left, inventing new rights and finding all kinds of rights that are not enumerated or stated in the Constitution. And I could go into the graphic detail about what he's been doing. But when it comes to the rights of parents, all of a sudden he can't find anything. And that's one of the great frustrations. Stacy, I appreciate your call. Keep listening. Let's go to Jeff calling from San Bernardino, California, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Jeff, it's your turn.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Good. I just have a couple comments. You're talking about microwave cooking, and
as far as people microwaving on Thanksgiving or any other time, they should really limit the use of it as far as anything that's of any nutritional value, because microwave cooking constantly destroys all nutritional value of food. And you said something earlier about women, good thing that most women can cook. I know worldwide that men are considered to be the very best cooks. And myself, that's my Thanksgiving Day turkey and stuffing against anybody's anywhere, anytime.
Jeff, I just have to tell you that I think there are probably people all over the world who are ready to call and enter into a debate over this. And you may have just launched one of the great debates between the sexes of all time. And, you know, I'll just tell you that with most of the people I know, I'm thankful that it's the women who are cooking. And God bless you for being a great cook. And, you know, a lot of the great chefs in the world are men, no doubt about that. But I just don't know that a lot of the great cooks in the world are dads. I mean, just to be honest, I think somehow that just doesn't work. My wife says that I forgot how to make toast the minute I said I do at the wedding altar. And, you know, when I was a college student, when I was single, I could feed myself. It was nothing glorious, trust me. I tried to fry chicken one time. I was so ambitious, I decided to fry chicken, and you know what? I did it just the way I thought my mother did it. I did it, and it looked so good. I sat down to eat it. It looked so good. It was like an advertisement for a restaurant, and I cut into it, and it was raw on the inside. I was about as disgusted as I could ever be. I have never tried anything like that again. Now, there are men who do other things in terms of cooking. My friend and colleague Clark Logan is headed home right now to fry turkeys. He's going to fry three of them. Clark's in Mississippi. Down there, they know how to do this. You know, I never even heard of fried turkey until just recently. And little did I know that it is one of the major causes of people visiting emergency rooms all across America on Thanksgiving Day. As a matter of fact, I was told last year from a press report, 670 different injuries were reported across America from people frying turkeys last year. So if you're going to fry your turkey, let me invite you to go to the Louisiana State University Agricultural Schools site. It's lsuagcenter.com, where you can find directions on safely frying a turkey. So be careful out there. And of course, you got to make sure that the turkey's not being too aggressive before you try to fire and fry him. Folks, it's Ask Anything Wednesday. You get to set the agenda. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll talk about what's on your mind. Of course, Thanksgiving is on the horizon as we are headed towards Thanksgiving Day tomorrow. But the news just never stops. When you start looking at, and by the way, this is an American holiday. And that's something else. You know, Canada celebrates Thanksgiving at a different time. You know, the London Stock Exchange is going to be open tomorrow. It's not a particularly special day in other parts of the world. And it's an American holiday. And for reasons deeply rooted in our nation's history. Let's remember that. 1621, the first pilgrims. That fantastic day when they gave thanks to God with that festival meal shared with some of the neighboring Indians. And let's not forget that this is a part of our national heritage, a part of our own nation's history, and it's a part of what makes this nation special. President George Washington declared Thanksgiving to be a national holiday in 1789 with an official proclamation, and it has been repeated subsequently by most presidents, and now it's a national holiday. And President George W. Bush from the White House issued the 2005 Thanksgiving Proclamation this year. But, folks, it's not just about officialdom, and it's not just about history. It's, of course, about what we do with our own families. You know, as you're traveling to or maybe right now receiving others who are traveling to you as family, or whether you're just in your home preparing for your own household for tomorrow for this great meal, I hope that you'll be thinking about how particularly to go through maybe just the last year and be very strategic and specific about the things for which we're thankful. And you just think about all that has taken place, the very fact that we're here, the very fact that we're able to have this conversation, the very fact that we're able to travel to family, the very fact that we're able to share such a meal, that reminds us that Thanksgiving ought to be the first impulse of the human heart. When it's not, something's gone wrong. We can get too busy, too distracted, too self-sufficient, too self-assured, and thus we can forget that gratitude is our first impulse if we're thinking rightly. Folks, let's Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about whatever is on your mind. It could be culture, politics, the Bible, theology. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We got calls coming in. We'll get to your questions when we come right back. I'm Albert Mohler.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This is the day before Thanksgiving, and there's an awful lot of activity across America. Some folks are having a difficult time in their travel due to snow in the Northeast and winds and other weather phenomena elsewhere. Be careful, go slowly, and arrive safely, and I pray everyone gets exactly where you're headed to be with family and with friends for Thanksgiving tomorrow. And it's one of those great times of the year when we just remind ourselves that family is a priority. And there's something very, very sweet and special about that. Let's go to Calvin, calling from Denver, Colorado, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Calvin, your turn.
Dr. Mohler, what a wonderful thing to hear you on XM and to know that you're being broadcast all over the country. Was reading your weblog recently about the revision of Christmas and the people who are trying to take Christ out of Christmas. And I had to wonder, you know, we talk about Thanksgiving and people talk about it generically, but do you think in this day and age that a lot of people really know who to give thanks to?
Calvin, I want you to hang with me for just a minute, and I'm going to out you right here on national radio. This is Calvin Whitman. My good friend is pastor of the Applewood Baptist Church in Denver, Colorado, and if it's not, I don't trust my ability to hear a voice. Calvin, I appreciate your call. I want you to hang with me and talk with me for a moment about this. Yeah, I think that's one of the big problems. I think that that it's complicated and even extended by the fact that in our secular society, we talk about giving thanks as if it's just an emotional state. You know, we're just somehow conjure up some kind of gratitude in our hearts. Gratitude is always specifically addressed to the one to whom gratitude is due. And in this case, let's remember the Pilgrims, 1621. They weren't giving thanks to the Indians against some of the politically correct stuff you hear in schools these days. And they weren't giving thanks to each other. They weren't just giving thanks to some kind of New Age exercise. They were giving thanks to God, the Creator, who had sustained them through the adversities of a very difficult year. Calvin, do you find this to be a challenge in your own pastoral ministry?
Well, absolutely. And I think that more and more we're living in a culture that is increasingly intolerant of Christianity because we have these holidays, Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, that go back to our Christian heritage as a country. But the reality is, in this increasingly secular, in fact, anti-Christ society that we live in, we have people not wanting to recognize the religious foundations of our country, and thus they want to try some kind of revisionism and take the spiritual, the Christian element out of these holidays.
Yeah, I think that there's a real secular victory in doing that. And, you know, on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about this as well on the program for Thanksgiving Day. And one of the things I'm going to talk about there is the fact that it's increasingly dismissed as Turkey Day, as if poultry is the point rather than Thanksgiving. Calvin, how do you fight that there in Denver? In other words, how do you help to keep the focus on what Thanksgiving is all about?
Well, of course, as Christians, I think we have a responsibility to be salt and light. And when we talk about Thanksgiving with our friends, whether they're at work, whether they're at the grocery store, and we say Happy Thanksgiving, we say Merry Christmas. I mean, we always want to say, yes, I thank God for all the blessings. Or we always want to bring to the table, to the conversation, the fact that we know what the holiday is all about. And then we want to live a life and demonstrate to the world around us that Jesus does make a difference so that, you know, we're not just celebrating a holiday out of rote tradition. We are genuinely in relationship with this living God, and we have reason to give thanks to him. And I think the world's going to be won, or the U.S. is going to be won back, one by one. And it's going to be the example that we set and the life that we live as we interact with individuals in the culture.
Calvin, thank you so much for your call. It's great to hear from you. I hope you and Diane and your family have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving together. And this gives me an opportunity to say I thank God on this Thanksgiving season for friends. And I hope you do as well. That is a precious gift that God gives us, and it's always good to hear from them. Let's go very quickly to Jeff, calling from Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on WTSJ. Jeff, your turn.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to got a quick question. I just want to get your take on when you think the angels might have been created, and if you have a particular time when you think Satan might have fell.
You know, Jeff, that is a fascinating question. I'm going to have to tease a little bit out of you here to kind of figure out how best to answer that. When you say when, you know, how are you thinking about that? Because it took place before the creation of the world. We know that. And we know that there was a rebellion in heaven. So, you know, so far as I know, the best we can say in terms of what the Bible teaches is that it took place after the creation of time, in that when God created these other beings, And obviously, there was some chronology in the fact there was this rebellion in heaven when Satan rebelled and took so many rebellious angels with him. But I have to think of dated time in terms of the history of creation. Is that what you're looking for, Jeff?
Somewhat, yes.
Okay, what am I missing here? Just help me.
Well, because when I look at Genesis, I look at when God looks back at time and he says all creation, he says everything is very good.
Yeah.
I can't see Satan falling then.
Well, see, I think that's a fascinating point, Jeff. And as a matter of fact, that's something I hadn't even thought about before. But I think the Genesis declaration about creation being very good is about the creation of Earth. Because as I look at biblical history, I think Satan's already fallen, and that explains why in Genesis 3, the human fall comes so quickly. Fascinating question. We'll be right back. Boy, I am so sorry we missed Tom. He was calling to talk about the legacy of Adrian Rogers, and we lost him on the line before we could get to him. But that gives me the opportunity to say something very important here, and that is that one of the things for which I'm most thankful as I think about this Thanksgiving Day is the fact that God has raised up so many faithful pastors for his church, and Adrian Rogers was one of those. And he died last week in Memphis, Tennessee, where he had been pastor of the Great Bellevue Baptist Church for more than 30 years, three times elected president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and one of the great Christian statesmen of our time. I'm honored to have known him as a friend. Of course, millions saw him through his television ministry. He was one of those men who stood for God's truth in a difficult time, did so with great integrity, unblemished courage. And he's one of those voices that will be just so tremendously missed, one of the greatest, most powerful preachers I have ever known. And it was a wonderful thing to be at his funeral. In this sense, the wonderful part of it was knowing that here was a man who finished well and whose life could be celebrated and for whom so many prayers of thanksgiving could be given. And Tom's back on the line. Tom, you're listening to XM Satellite Radio. We're glad to have you. Thanks for raising Adrian Rogers. Tell me, what did he mean to you?
Thank you. Well, I was a law student back in the early 1970s at Memphis State. I was a member of the Bellevue Baptist Church, and he kind of helped me stay on track during law school. And then I went to Ridgecrest several times and heard him. He was a real inspiration. And then later hearing him on his radio program, and I would say there's very few people that had a passion and enthusiasm for the Word and an uncompromising preaching of the truth of God's Word like Dr. Rogers. And I'd just like to ask you, what do you feel like his main legacy is that he'll leave for us?
You know, Tom, that is a great question, and I'm going to answer it in a way that may surprise some people. I believe that, that in a biblical understanding, that that his first most important legacies are going to be through his church and through his family. I think that's where Adrian Rogers' legacy will last the longest, because there the lives were immediately touched. I mean, right there within his family, wonderful family, Joyce Rogers, his widow, and their four children and their families, there you see the influence of a godly father and a godly grandfather. And by the way, the Rogers' first great-grandchild was born in the same city the day before Dr. Rogers died. And yet also in that church, you see such a legacy. And there are people there who came to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior through his preaching. They were raised under his biblical preaching. And many of them, with 30 years, they grew from infancy all the way to adulthood and into their own parenthood through the years of his ministry. I think that's where the legacy will be most centered. I think also in the Southern Baptist Convention, because you really can't talk about the conservative resurgence in America's largest evangelical denomination without looking to Adrian Rogers as the pastor whom God raised up to be the general and the voice in that. And, I would not be where I am now as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary if Dr. Rogers had not been so faithful and the Lord had not raised him up for that purpose. And so that's a very personal question to me. I think his legacy will be through thousands of God-called preachers and missionaries who Dr. Rogers would never see, whose theological education and opportunities for ministry were impacted for such glorious good through his own ministry. And then, Tom, I think his ministry will be worldwide through the continued effect of his preaching, because, the God's Word never returns void. And, I'm thankful for that, too. Tom, I'm thankful that you got back on the line. It was great to hear from you, and it was great to be able to talk for a moment about one of God's great statesmen in this generation and to celebrate the fact that God gave us such a man as Adrian Rogers. And sometimes it's only when a man dies that we really understand, just how much we've lost. I think we all knew with Adrian Rogers that we would lose so much. And, you know, just at the graveside ceremony and at the funeral last week, what a sound of triumph because of the gospel. But also the real sense that even though we do not grieve as others grieve, we can't. We do understand that we've lost something very important, and we need to be thankful the Lord gave him to us for so long. Let's go to Brian calling from Charlottesville, Virginia, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Brian, we'll get you in here.
Hi, Dr. Moore. Real quick, I've noticed in my own reading and listening to some Christian speakers, some great men in the church, that I've noticed that they've painted a caricature of other leaders that may have opposing viewpoints, and oftentimes they're addressing arguments and committing a straw man fallacy.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what would be your pastoral advice if I have interaction and contact with these men? How do I approach that, and how would I discuss with them how they've maybe misrepresented the opposing side?
Well, you know, what a sensitive and, I think, godly question, Brian. I appreciate that. And let me say that this is a temptation and a sin that that we all can commit. And especially when we're debating great and important and urgent issues, it's very easy. Sometimes almost in ways that we don't even recognize, it's very easy to create a straw man and to misrepresent to what those opposing us would really believe and would really say. And, you know, Brian, I think this is a reminder to us that the church, as the body of Christ, needs to call its members on this, and especially when they are in Christian leadership positions. You know, just going to Matthew 18, I think the first thing to do would be to approach such a person directly and just make your case as sensitively and honestly as possible, saying, I think you misrepresented this person. And then Matthew 18 says, if that does not work, in other words, if that it does not lead to an understanding that is commensurate with the gospel and with truth, then you may need to bring some witnesses. Now, you know, the problem is in all of this that we have a lack of church discipline. We have a lack of concern in the larger evangelical world for how, you know, appropriately to do this. And so it so often ends up just being, you know, a public controversy. I really appreciate the spirit that I heard in your question. And I think the big issue there is that we've got to do our very best to try to deal with this at the personal level. And so I would encourage you, if you know this leader, talk to him. If you can write him, write him. Maybe you'll get a chance to talk to him and, you know, help him to see this. And maybe you can come to a common understanding of how this ought to be done and how these issues ought to be addressed. And if not, maybe you need to broaden it. But I really fear, you know, that we need to avoid making a scandal here. I'm worried about the fact that we don't want to compound one scandal with another scandal before the world. And so I appreciate your spirit. I pray the Lord will give you wisdom. But I think this is where, you know, some senior Christian statesmen can often be effective in talking to each other about these things. But we need to be ready to hear from anyone. And Brian, you know, you obviously have a very thoughtful approach to this. I would share it. If it's a burden, a conviction in your heart, write a letter, make a phone call, you know, and give the person you think has offended here, give him the benefit of the doubt. He just may very well be convinced by your argument and want to do the right thing. Thanks so much for your call, folks. It's been Ask Anything Wednesday, and we've got one final call we're going to try to get when we come right out of this break. You know, a lot of folks are hurrying here and there to get home for Thanksgiving, but this is a reminder to us that the issues keep coming. Even as we approach a celebration and a holiday, the world's not going to stand still. I'll be right back with some final thoughts in just a moment. It's Ask Anything Wednesday and Coast to Coast. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the final minutes of the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to take one more call and Ask Anything Wednesday. We're going to go to Jason from Mansfield, Connecticut. Jason, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. My question to you is about tithes and offerings. I'm pretty new in my spiritual walk, probably about 8 months, and I do give to my church on a regular basis, and I do attend on a regular basis, but I also try and fill my life with evangelists on television and reading books. And one of the things that I'm getting from, especially the ones that I do watch on television, is the fact that they are also asking for money. Now, how do I, as a Christian, decide where to put my money in God? Is it to my church? Do I give to, you know, do I have to give to these evangelists that I watch on television because they are providing me with information? What is the general rule, in your opinion, on giving tithes and offerings to a multitude of evangelists, I guess,
yeah,
for lack of a better term.
Jason, what a great and honest question there. And let me just be real honest here and say on my part that I'm a president of a theological seminary and a college, and we're dependent upon the support of Christians who believe in what we're doing. But I want to say, just in unequivocal terms, that the most important thing I think Scripture would have us to do as Christians is to exercise our stewardship by investing in the local church. I think that is first and foremost at all times. And I think the reason for that is very clear. If the local church doesn't have what it needs, then nothing else really matters. All these other ministries will simply dry up and drivel and just be no more, wither away. And so the local church is what's most important. You know, in the book of Acts, in the New Testament, you won't find evangelistic associations. I have to say, you won't even find a seminary or a college. You will find the local church. And, you know, in the Old Testament, the standard was the tithe. And certainly under the New Covenant, the expectation for us should not be less, but I would think even more. It's not the law so much as it is the understanding that God now is the owner of all things, and that he is the Lord of all things. And he owns everything we have. We're the stewards, and therefore everything we have should be at God's disposal. So, Jason, you ask an important question, and this could take hours of time, fruitfully, for us to discuss. But I just want to say as quickly as possible that my first principle would be to invest as generously as I can in the local church. And then, as the Lord allows, be strategic in finding some Christian ministries where you can be focused and where you believe they're preaching and teaching the Word of God, defending and teaching the gospel. And invest strategically in those where you can make a difference. And I would just say that giving a little bit to a lot may be less effective than giving a lot to fewer organizations. And where you can have some real input and you know that there's real accountability. So that you as a Christian are giving to those causes that are really going to be doing what you believe should be done. Saying and teaching what you believe ought to be taught. Jason, thanks so much for your call. And I pray God's blessing on you this Thanksgiving and to all of you who have joined in listening. You know, Thanksgiving sometimes does not come naturally to us because we feel so self-secure. I hope that you and your loved ones, as you gather together this Thanksgiving, will understand there's no security but in God, from whom we received all things, and to him we must be ultimately and always thankful. We'll be back tomorrow. God bless you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.